Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's just coming up on 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. And I've got a show lined up that sounds pretty good. Dr. Allison Bidlack will be coming in to tell us about a talk she's delivering tonight. She's the director of the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center. She's doing UAS's Evening at Egan presentation. Lisa Golosek will drop by from the Alaska State Museum to tell us about some upcoming activities there. Chelsea Fields, organizer for Saturday's Community Health Fair at the mall, and Nora Marks Dauernauer, the newly appointed state writer laureate for Alaska, will join us. The weather forecast is for rain, and if you look outside, it's for snain, folks. The white stuff is actually mixed in there right now.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. During last night's vice presidential debate, Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan briefly mentioned meeting an enlisted Menominee soldier while visiting Afghanistan. Ryan's comment came after the debate moderator asked whether it was time for the U.S. to leave Afghanistan, to which the vice presidential contender recalled two of his trips to the country.
First time I was there in 2002, it was amazing to me what they were facing. And I went to the Argonaut Valley in Kandahar before the surge. I sat down with a young private in the 82nd from the Menominee Indian Reservation who would tell me what he did every day, and I was in awe. And to see what they had in front of them, and then to go back there in December, to go throughout Helmand with the Marines to see what they had accomplished, it's nothing short of amazing.
Despite the brief mention, neither Vice Presidential hopeful Paul Ryan or Vice President Joe Biden discussed anything related to Indian country or policy. Advocates say the Reed-Gardner power plant outside Las Vegas, Nevada should be retired. Conservationists from the Sierra Club say closing the 50-year-old coal-fired power plant would improve the health of those living near it, including the Moapa Paiutes. Mike Clifford has more.
The plant was called Nevada's Big Dirty Secret by Jane Feldman of the Southern Nevada Group of the Sierra Club. She testified Thursday telling the Public Utilities Commission that the 50-year-old coal-fired power plant is responsible for $28 million in public health costs each year.
We know that closing Reed Gardner will also clean up the air and relieve the health burden that the Moapa Paiutes and other people who live here in the region are under because of burning coal at Reed Gardner.
Feldman told the commission that more than 600,000 Nevadans, young and old, who are at risk for asthma and cardiovascular disease, would be a lot healthier if the plant is retired. The Public Utilities Commission took testimony in two sessions on Thursday in what was the final scheduled hearing on the future of Reed Gardner for 2012. Mike Clifford, Nevada News Service.
A well-known restaurant in interior Alaska's largest city is smoke-free. The move came Wednesday in partnership with the Tanana Chiefs Conference. From KUAC in Fairbanks, Emily Chuing reports.
In 2011, the Alaska Federation of Natives unanimously passed a resolution in support of statewide smoke-free workplaces. Melanie Brenner is the Tobacco Prevention Coordinator at Tanana Chiefs Conference. She recently helped a restaurant in Fairbanks go smoke-free. She says the effort reaches beyond Fairbanks to villages across interior Alaska.
In Nulato, they have a tribal policy there which protects for all tribal buildings and also any events that are happening. And in Galena, they passed a policy for any of the TCC properties to be smoke-free, and Nemana just recently had all their tribal offices go tobacco-free.
There is no statewide law regarding tobacco use in the workplace in Alaska. Communities across the state have been slow to adopt the change, but Brenner says the movement is gaining traction in some of Alaska's more remote villages because of an increase in education. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Government officials in Brazil are using the indigenous language of Ticuna to spread awareness of violence against women and the spread of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. Over 30,000 indigenous people in Brazil speak the language, and flyers in the Ticuna language are being distributed, warning that violence and forced unprotected sex can increase women's vulnerability to HIV and other STDs. Ticuna speakers live on the border of Brazil near Peru and Colombia, where drug trafficking and prostitution are rampant. On this day in 1964, Oglala Lakota athlete Billy Mills stunned the world with his Olympic victory, winning the 10,000-meter run in Tokyo. His breathtaking come-from-behind finish has been called the most sensational race in Olympic history by several news accounts. Mills currently serves as the national spokesperson for Running Strong for American Indian Youth. This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Autown.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 5.5 minutes. It's actually almost 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. My first guest is going to tell us about a program tonight at the evening at Egan. We're hoping also to get some details on a little bit of her career. Dr. Allison Bidlack from the University of Alaska Southeast, who is the director of the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center, is here with me. Hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So on a snainy afternoon, did you see those white flakes out there?
Yes.
Yeah, it's time.
I did. They were falling on my dashboard as I came.
Yes. Yeah. So rainforests, huh? That's been a big interest of yours, I think, for a while, right?
It has been. I first moved up to Alaska in 1997 to work on a master's degree at University of Alaska Fairbanks, but I did all of my field work down here in southeast Alaska, mostly on Prince of Wales Island and the islands to the west of it. And so immediately fell in love with just the landscape and everything about it.
I get into conversations with people on the telephone, and I say to them, we live in a rainforest here. And, their thought is, no, it couldn't be because they don't have birds in the treetops.
Right.
And all
there's no monkeys. There's no sloths.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. But we are a rainforest. Why?
We are. It's based on a couple different things, but mostly, obviously, the amount of rainfall. We are a temperate rainforest, and so there are temperate rainforests scattered throughout the world. Chile, for example, New Zealand, many parts of Japan and China. Ireland used to be a temperate rainforest before they cut most of their trees down. The coast of Norway and Sweden as well. So we're one of many different temperate rainforests around the world, but the interesting thing is that most of the temperate rainforests are much, much smaller than the tropical rainforest that we're used to thinking about in South America or Central Africa.
So what part of Alaska comprises the temperate rainforest?
It actually extends from Kodiak Island and Cook Inlet in the north all the way down to the Redwood Forest of California. Prince William Sound is considered subpolar temperate rainforest. We are considered to be in the perhumid temperate rainforest, and perhumid just basically means always wet.
Gee. I could have guessed.
Right.
So now this presentation tonight is about collaborative research in Southeast Alaska, which takes place because we are in the rainforest and brings together a number of scientific disciplines and some industrial forces and so forth. Could you tell us a little bit about who all is involved in this?
Yeah, so we're going to have a panel of speakers tonight. I am going to give an introduction about the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center itself and tell folks a little bit about what we do and why we were formed about 3 years ago. And then we're going to have three different speakers, Dr. Jan Straley from UA Southeast in Sitka, Dr. Rick Edwards from the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Lab here in Juneau, and then Dr. Anne Boudreau, who's an assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. And they're going to be talking about the research that they've been involved with in Southeast Alaska. And all of their research programs are collaborative in nature. Jan's, in particular, she works with the fishing fleet, the longline fishing fleet, to work on sperm whale predation issues. Rick Edwards will be talking about the Hien-Latini Experimental Forest and the opportunities for collaboration there between the university, Central Council of Tlingit and Haida, who have been working there for a little bit, and then UAS. And then Anne Boudreau will be talking about some of the collaborative work she's involved with a very large group of researchers throughout the state working on some work in Berners Bay, looking at impacts of climate change on glaciers and the runoff from glaciers then impacting the marine system.
And maybe this is an unfair question for someone whose specialty is rainforest, but I'm wondering how widely this model of collaborative research between among academic institutions and industrial operations, how widespread is that?
Well, I actually think it's becoming more and more widespread because I think academics realize that there's a lot of expertise, or are realizing there's a lot of expertise, of course, outside of academia, outside of that ivory tower. And so, you know, working with, say, the fishing community can be very productive because, of course, the fishermen know a lot about the marine system that they work in, particularly if they've been fishing for a long time. So that's one example. So I think that there's other examples like that in other parts of the United States that are becoming more and more prevalent.
Have you had any other experience with those kinds of things in your career?
A little bit. I've been working in the Copper River for the last four years or so, and I was working for an environmental organization called EcoTrust, and we actually worked quite a bit. EcoTrust works quite a bit with the fishing communities in the Pacific Northwest, and so I was a little bit working on the periphery of that, of some of those projects.
When you do this kind of collaboration, is there like who takes the lead?
Well, that's a good question. I think in some ways the academics can take the lead because they're generally the ones that come up with the funding, and so come up with sort of the research plan, if you will, and get the funding for the research. But then, and so I think they take the lead in kind of organizing the project, in say gathering and synthesizing the data. But oftentimes, if there's industry folks involved, they may take the lead really in helping that academic think about the best design, say, for a research program, or think about maybe the best times of the year to go out and do something, or even the best way to think about how to analyze it, because they may have a completely different perspective than the academic would.
The media always, when you do a film or something like that, you're always trying to create or to have tension in the film. And so it's very common, there's a very common kind of thread that runs through lots of film stories and novels occasionally that has the industry kind of being the corrupting influence on an academic study. Do you find any of that here?
No. I don't feel corrupted, nor do I think that academics normally do either.
It's so common in films. I'm thinking particularly of science fiction films in which there are, you know, in which the corporation is some kind of big faceless entity that wants everyone
sure,
to do something
sure,
bad.
The big bio pharma,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you're not in that business.
Not really in that business. No.
So, I guess this talk that is going to be given tonight, I'm wondering who you're thinking you would like to see out in the audience.
Well, I'd hope that folks that live and work in Juneau and in Southeast Alaska would come. One of the goals of the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center is public education and outreach, and letting people know, educating people about the rainforest. And when I say the rainforest, I don't mean that in just an ecological sense. I mean it in a social sense, in a cultural sense, in an economic sense. So educating people about the system in which they live, how it's being impacted by climate change and other human-caused factors, and how we can better manage, you know, better understand and manage the resources. We're here to educate and inform, and so I hope that lots of people come tonight.
This kind of leads to a question about broader collaboration, and we talked about this a little bit before we opened up the microphones, and that is that there are programs. There's one program at UAS I know of in particular, and there are other programs that you were telling me about in other places where the arts and literature have come to collaborate with the sciences to create new ways of looking at something like a rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a program outside.
That's right. Yeah, there's actually two programs that I am familiar with. One, I actually interacted with a little bit this summer, and that was up in McCarthy, so the Wrangell Mountain Center. I think that's the right name for it. They have an artist in residence program, and they have programs in the summer on poetry and creating art based sort of on the mountains, the mountain ecosystem. But then there's also the H.G. Andrews Experimental Forest down in Oregon, which also has, that is a U.S. Forest Service and Oregon State University co-managed experimental forest, but they have also an artist in residence program. And I think that's just a really interesting idea. We have a brand new experimental forest here in Juneau, which Rick Edwards will be talking about tonight. And already he's been working very extensively with Central Council on incorporating some of the traditional ecological knowledge into a classroom curricula for children. And so I've thought about doing the same sort of thing, but with a traditional cultural knowledge and thinking about how to sort of work that in. And so also been talking to some of the English faculty here at UAS about, again, doing maybe some sort of an artist or writer in residence with the Hinlatini Experimental Forest.
Where is that forest, Stone?
It's Davies and Cowrie Creeks in Berners Bay. At the end of the road system.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, tonight the presentation, I think, begins at 7. Right? And it's in Egan Lecture Hall, I assume.
Yep.
Yep. So evening at Egan tonight, collaborative research in Southeast Alaska. Dr. Allison Bidlack will be moderating the panel, and the panel includes
Dr. Jan Straley from UAS Sitka, Dr. Rick Edwards from U.S. Forest Service, and Dr. Anne Boudreau from UAF.
Wonderful. I hope you get a big turnout.
Great. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thanks for coming down. After 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News, and we're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next guest is Lisa Galisic. She's here from the State Museum next door to KTOO Studios and going to talk to us about some upcoming youth activities at the museum. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you.
So what's happening?
Well, you know, we're kicking off our series of youth activities for the school year. What we try to do is when we have guest artists who have solo exhibitions at the Alaska State Museum, we try to have them work with kids and be inspired by their works that are on the walls, teach them some techniques or talk about their subject matter and then let them go and create with some of the same tools and materials they use. Unfortunately, tomorrow's activities are full, but it starts the line. Up and these first two are inspired by the works of Dan DeRue that's on display, and so M.K. McNaughton is working with K-1-2s, and Dan is working with 3rd through 5th graders. And then we will have another activity, though, coming up the beginning of November, November 3rd, with Kristen Link, who is a scientific illustrator, and her works are going on display for a couple months.
Well, when they have these activities, what do the kids get to do?
Well, the kids get to do art and with the materials. Usually they're a specific subject, like this first one is drawing and painting. The next one is scientific illustration. So it's looking at nature and drawing from skulls and bones and paws. Another one that will be coming up is weaving over Christmas break. We'll do something with photography and learning about how lenses and the kids will make like small cameras using lenses and how light through lens can be used to create imagery. And so they'll be making images. So it's very hands-on that the kids will create things that they take home from every one of these activities.
How long does one of the activities last?
The activities are short. It's really an introduction, so it's a two-hour time period. We encourage parents to come with younger kids, but they're directed for these audiences, and sometimes we have extra materials for the parents so that they don't get in the kids' way. And just let those kids go.
A good strategy.
That's our strategy, anyway.
Go away, Mom.
And, you know, people often ask how we advertise those things, and we do send flyers home through the school. They go home with kids in their backpacks generally. We advertise them like this on K2, and we get them in the radio. So these activities are all free, mm-hmm. and they are hosted by the Friends of the Alaska State Museum that writes a grant, a youth activity grant. So it's paid for in part by the citizens of the city and borough of Juneau through sales tax revenue.
So when you come to one of these, do you pay admission to the museum?
No.
No,
you do not.
So, okay.
So the whole event is free, and you can sneak in and see all the other exhibits.
Duh.
So tomorrow is sort of a free day to come to the museum, and it is a last opportunity to see the World War II history exhibit that we have over here, over there, and then also Dan DeRue's painting exhibit that are up, and it's a great opportunity to see the Filipino-American community history exhibit that is on display in honor of Filipino-American History Month this month.
So. I have to say, if you haven't seen those two exhibits, the World War II stuff is just fascinating, but Dan DeRue's stuff is a hoot.
Yes, it is.
It's just, it's a howler, and you don't expect it. You walk into that room, and it just takes you away.
Oh, thanks for bringing that up, and I think that really is true, and I hope you'll have kids in the room next door, in the art room, making a little bit of noise, but Dan is there working with kids, but there's that opportunity to still look at that exhibit, and it is a really fun exhibit. And both of them are great exhibits, as well as this Filipino exhibit, if you haven't seen it. And the Filipino exhibit is just up till the end of the month, so we're already midway through the month, and so it's only up through the 27th. So I encourage people to come in, and like I said, tomorrow's free.
Yeah. Lisa, this is a great extension of the university's program. Thank you very much for telling us about
okay.
it.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
This event is Alaskan High Kick. It's an event that requires both physical strength and mental stuff, you know. My name is Christian Paul. I'm from Kipnuk, and I am 19 years old.
Christian is constantly moving on the sidelines here at the 2012 World Eskimo Indian Olympics in Fairbanks. It's his first time competing at WIO, although he's often been to the statewide Native Youth Olympics. He says he enjoys many of these physically challenging events, but there are only a couple he concentrates on.
An elder coach once told me that he just looked at me and told me I had the perfect body, like the perfect physique for kneel jump and seal hop / knuckle hop. And he told me that if I wanted to excel, he told me to do all the other events for fun, but just focus on just those two events.
Christian recently graduated from Mount Edgecombe High School, and he plans to go to the University of Alaska Fairbanks for college this fall. His academic aspirations tie in with the competition he's at today. Christian will focus on Alaska Native Studies with an emphasis on Yupik, the language of his region. He says being involved with Alaska Native sporting events helps him keep connected to his cultural roots. That's important for Christian's future leadership plans.
To be a leader, you not only have to have the words and the right motive, but you have to be able to set yourself as an example to younger people and other people who want to be inspired.
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
24 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next guest is here to tell us about a community health fair that's coming up, I think, at Nugget Mall.
That's right.
This weekend. Chelsea Fields, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
So here's a chance to get your blood pressure checked out.
And that's right.
A few things like that.
That's right. There'll be some nurses there able to take blood pressures, which is part of the process of getting your blood drawn. So they'll be there to do that for you. And you can come and have your blood pressure taken even if you're not having blood drawn. It's just one of the free screenings that we offer at the health fair.
So how does this – let's say I come and I get this. How does my physician get access to this set of results?
Well, after you have your blood drawn, you will self-address an envelope actually at the fair. We'll collect those from you, and then we send you the test results directly in the mail to be sent to you. So then at that time, you can take those results to your doctor. We also, if you would prefer, you can sign a release form, and we can send a copy of the test results to your doctor.
So when I get this in the mail, this self-addressed envelope, it's going to have these numbers on it and like that. How am I going to know what that means?
We send you a pamphlet with the test results that kind of explains what some of those numbers mean. And we also, too, have a nurse who comes in after some of the health fairs, after a few of the health fairs, and she makes callbacks where she'll call people who have out-of-range numbers just to let them know that it's probably a good idea to follow up with your health care provider.
Mm-hmm. So what else, other than blood tests and blood pressure checks, what else are you offering?
We are offering vision screenings and hearing screenings, and those are both free. The blood tests are actually the only thing at the fair that costs. It's an extra cost. And there will also be many exhibitors from the Juneau community there educating on a health or safety topic. So
I think one of our biggest problems in Alaska is probably alcoholism, but we have other health concerns as well, I think, in the state. What else should we are we conscious of? What else is particularly on the radar for health providers in Alaska?
I guess I'm not a healthcare provider and I'm not a nurse, but I know that one of the common health matters that we do at the health fair is diabetes. We often have colorectal cancer educators who come and educate on that. At the health fair, we also offer at-home colon cancer screenings for $5. It's a simple test that also gives you the tools to figure out if it's something you need to follow up with your doctor about. We have prostate health educators who come. Those are just some examples of a few of the common topics mm-hmm. that we have at the health fair.
I heard something on a radio show the other day that was on a newscast, and they were talking about the fact that we are probably going to increasingly move toward testing outside of doctors' offices, that more and more there will be opportunities for things like this because as we move toward trying to reduce the cost of medical care, more of this kind of testing will probably be the rule rather than – so if you get routine tests like this, then you can sort of not have that be part of the expense of your medical care.
Right, and one of the main goals of the health fair is to put the tools in the individual's hands to make their own health care decisions. We kind of act as a vehicle for people to take responsibility and to be able to make their own personal decisions instead of a lot of people. We hear from a lot of people, they come to the health fair because they don't like going to a doctor's office. And so one of the things that we pride ourselves in is giving people the tools to do that. And then giving them also information that may help them seek medical attention if that's necessary.
So it's a little more relaxing, I imagine. I mean, this is a mall setting. It's not quite the same as waiting in the waiting room and then getting called and all of that sort of stuff.
There can be a wait.
Yeah.
We offer all of our blood tests at cost, which can be kind of a popular thing for people. Our main test is $45. So that's a big calling for a lot of people who are interested in coming to the health fair. So there can be a line, I won't lie. But it is a great opportunity for a lot of people who are underinsured or uninsured or have insurance, but the cost of the blood tests at the health fair is still cheaper than what they would get through their insurance company.
So you've done a few of these, I think, right?
I have, yeah.
How did you get involved in planning these?
I moved to Alaska a little over a year ago, and I found the job listed online somewhere, and I applied for it thinking, oh, this sounds kind of interesting. And I actually started as the assistant program director, and now I'm the Southeast program director. So I kind of moved up a little bit,
yeah.
And now this is my second season doing fairs here.
Well, congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you.
So the door's open at
9 a.m.
9 a.m. The mall actually opens at 10, so there's
right,
a chance.
Right, so we'll be there a little early.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 9 a.m., and the last a person who can go through and get the tests will be served at?
1 p.m.
1 p.m., mm-hmm. So you must be there no later than 1 p.m.
That's correct.
And you can come as early as 9 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Okay, $45 cost for the blood screening, but the other tests are free? Is that...
The chemistry is $45, and then we offer some additional tests at an additional cost.
Okay, and that's all explained to you when you get there.
Yep,
like that.
You can pick okay. up a pricing list.
Well, outstanding. Thank you so much. At Nugget Mall, Saturday?
Tomorrow,
yeah. So 9 o'clock in the morning, get there before 1 and take advantage of this opportunity.
Hi, this is Scott Wagner.
And I'm Steve Schick. We're realtors with the Southeast Alaska Board of Realtors.
We understand that strong communities start in the home.
And that violence against women is destructive to women, families, and communities.
While not all men use violence,
we believe that all men have a responsibility to end it.
Through the White Ribbon Campaign,
I pledge not to commit, condone, or remain silent
about violence against women because
Alaska men choose respect.
This message brought to you by Juneau's Violence Prevention Coalition.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 12th of October, 2012. The great tradition of Oktoberfest goes back to this day in 1810, when the Crown Prince of Bavaria, Ludwig, was getting married to Princess Therese of Saxony. They wanted to invite the entire city of Munich along to celebrate. There was horse racing, and there was lots and lots of beer. And the Bavarians had such a good time, they decided to hold the same party the next year, and then again and again and again. These days, Oktoberfest starts in late September and goes for about 2 weeks. It's the birthday of the author and psychologist Robert Coles, born in Boston, 1929, author of more than 60 books. He was in the South at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. He was planning to be a child psychologist, and one day during a visit to New Orleans, 1960, he saw a white mob surrounding a six-year-old black girl named Ruby Bridges, who was kneeling in her starched white dress in the middle of it all to pray for the mob that was attacking her. And Coles decided to begin what would become his work for the next few decades, trying to understand how children and their parents come to terms with radical change, became his book Children of Crisis, which came out in 1967. Robert Coles said we should look inward and think about the meaning of our life and its purposes, lest we do it in 20 or 30 years and it's too late. It's the birthday of the poet and translator Robert Fitzgerald, born in Geneva, New York, 1910, best known for his English translations of Homer's Odyssey and the Iliad. He was classics professor at Harvard, and he liked to recite Homer out loud. And it's the birthday of the novelist Alice Childress, born in Charleston, South Carolina, 1916. She was a playwright, best known for her novels A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich and A Short Walk. Alice Childress, who said, "Life is just a short walk from the cradle to the grave, and it sure behooves us to be kind to one another along the way." Here's a poem for today by E.E. Cummings. All in green went my love riding. All in green went my love riding on a great horse of gold into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling, the merry deer ran before. Fleeter be they than dappled dreams, the swift sweet deer, the red rare deer. Four red roebuck at a white water, the cruel bugles sang before. Horn at hip went my love riding, riding echoed down into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling, the level meadows ran before. Softer be they than slippered sleep, the lean lithe deer, the fleet-flown deer. Four fleet does at a gold valley, the famished arrow sang before. Bow at belt went my love riding, riding the mountain down into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling. The sheer peaks ran before. Paler be they than daunting death, the sleek, slim deer, the tall, tense deer. Four tall stags at a green mountain, the lucky hunter sang before. All in green went my love riding on a great horse of gold into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling. My heart fell dead before. E.E. Cummings' poem, All in Green, went my love riding from his 100 selected poems, published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Nick Vetter, Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News.
Resbaló y al agua vino a caer, río se la hizo.
It's 17 minutes before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're in tune with KTOO News. I have a rare and wonderful privilege and honor today. The newly appointed writer laureate of the state of Alaska is here with me, and she is Nora Dauenauer. She'll be the writer laureate now for a 2-year period. Can you hear me?
I can hardly hear you.
Let me turn this up. Perhaps that'll be better.
Thank you.
There, good. Okay. So Nora and her husband Richard is with us as well. Hi, Richard.
Who?
Yeah. And congratulations on your being
Thank
appointed.
You.
You've joined a company of people who are highly respected. But the first question that I wanted to ask you is, does this mean now that Richard can't lord it over you anymore since he was the writer laureate in 1981?
What did he say?
Huh? I don't know if she heard the question.
Okay, I asked if this meant that Richard would not be lording it over you anymore since you were appointed the laureate in he was the laureate in 1981. So your program at the University of Alaska is really growing, I think, the Tlingit language program up there. You have a couple of new people involved in it, and they brought some real energy into that program. How long ago did you start that? When did it start?
The thing, she's having real trouble hearing.
I know, and I'm trying to get enough volume out of those headphones so she can hear what I'm saying. Let's see if all the way up helps.
I really need a hearing aid.
Ah, well. Can you hear any better now?
Yes.
Is that working? Oh, good. I was asking how long ago you started the Tlingit language-based program at UAS.
Geez. I think it was 83.
Yeah, it was a long time. We sort of inherited it. It kind of grew way back. Wally Olson was doing stuff with Catherine Mills, and we just kind of grew it. As you say, there's a lot of new youth and energy there, and we're just enjoying retirement at the moment.
I also worked at the Within Walls.
Yeah, that's another issue, just referring to the University Within Walls program that was way back in the late 70s, I think. It was Randall Ackley was here then, and the university, and offered writing and things like language within the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's way back.
I was interested in the interview in the article that was released to the press announcing your appointment. It said that you had spoken Tlingit when you were a girl, that was your primary language.
That was my first language.
First language. Mm-hmm. Were you part of the scene where so many Tlingit speakers were told not to speak their language in the school system?
We got punished.
Yeah. That, of course, is no more. Are young people...
Well, not physically anymore.
Hmm. Do young people now, are they able to speak Tlingit? Is the language emerging again?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going on at the college level or the school level. They might be teaching things about Tlingit, and also they might be teaching language.
I think the answer to the question is kids are learning, but you can't ever replace the hearing it from as the first language of the home. I mean, when you consider what a child at the age of 3 or 4 or 5 knows from hearing it constantly versus trying as an adult to learn it when we don't have that. I think they're learning it, but it's nothing like the range of fluency that a child would have in the old days.
The family that was speaking Tlingit my age were already brainwashed by my time. So it's really tough to make them believe that Tlingit is valuable. The kids really need it. When they get their language, they are just so happy. You could tell the difference. They're very happy, especially when they get a name in Tlingit.
What's the source of that happiness? Why? What makes them happy about having...
The language. Themselves, their family. So, and just to learn anything that's Tlingit.
And is this because it's like regaining an identity that you've lost?
Yes.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Your poetry, very often when I read it, I don't mean this negatively, but it's like poetry that is written by someone who started speaking a different language. The phraseology and the rhythm in what you write belies your Tlingit heritage. And it's always really. You brought a book. Can you read us some of your something today?
Which one do you like?
I would not deign to choose. I give that privilege to the author.
Thank you. What shall I read?
Oh, my favorite is Dancing with Machines. That's a good one.
Oh, okay.
That's really the ultimate Tlingit experience.
Salmon Egg Puller. Salmon Egg Puller, 2:15 an hour. You learn to dance with machines, keep time with the header, swing your arms, reach inside the salmon cavity with your left hand where the head was. Grab lightly top of egg sack. With fingers, pull gently but quick. Reach in immediately with right hand. For the lower egg sac, pull this gently. Slide them into a chute to catch the eggs. Reach into the next salmon. Do this 4 hours in the morning with a 15-minute coffee break. Go home for lunch. Attend to kids and feed them. Work 4 hours in the afternoon with a 15-minute coffee break. Go home for dinner. Attend to kids and feed them. It's stuck together. Go back for 2 more hours, 4 more hours. Reach, pull gently. Go home for the day. Attend to kids who missed you. When fingers start swelling, soak them in Epsom salts. If you don't have time, stand under a shower with your hands up under the spray. Get to bed early if you can. Next morning, if your fingers are sore, start dancing immediately. The pain will go away after icy fish with eggs.
Mm. I can, my fingers hurt.
That's hard work.
I've never done that, but I can tell you that my fingers hurt just listening to the thing. You catch that so wonderfully well because of some word choices. You said quick instead of quickly, which is exactly the way you hear it on the street. It's your ear that's very good, and you hear the way people speak and then put it into the page, and it's just a gift. So,
I have a poet laureate who gives me advice on what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, well, I get my advice from other poets laureates, too. Thank you. My latest manuscript was well worked over by Sheila Dickerson and old friends, so we all help each other out.
Well, Sheila was poet laureate in 1977,
mm-hmm.
and I had the joy of interviewing Peggy Shoemaker, who was down here. She came down from Fairbanks and brought her book with her and read a wonderful passage from it for us.
Peggy's been a good help to me, too. I have a book coming out next year with University of Alaska Press. So, again, Peggy was one of the people that went over, and Emily Walls here in town. We get help.
She was part of our group with the University Within Walls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I had a teeny bit of exposed to her.
I guess so. Now, you've written a couple of plays, right?
Yeah.
What?
God, that was Kichagun. That was part of my work. The base was my work.
Yeah.
Huh.
But yours are the Raven stories.
Yeah.
And then the two of you have collaborated recently on a set of, I think, four books?
Yes, that's the translations from Thinkin' Oral Literature. And Nora's the primary transcriber there and then translator. And then we argue about the translation and say, doesn't make sense. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. But, so those are, again, some of the... Most of the work that was recorded in the 70s and 60s even, some of the people that are, of course, long gone, that whole generation of masters of oral tradition.
So are you working on anything now?
Oh, yes, forever. We work on a Raven book now, Raven Stories, and that's the comic genre. We started out with that first. We thought everybody would like Raven Stories.
The first thing Dick said to me was, I want to hear Raven stories.
I like them.
We've been together for a long time, and we still haven't finished Raven stories.
40 years in the works. But the problem is we learned humor does not translate well across culture. So like if somebody gives you Japanese satire, you have really no way of knowing whether it's straight or... Is it funny? Are they ridiculing something if you just don't know? Where tragedy translates, unfortunately, quite well across cultures. Everybody understands death and dying and suffering and loss and grief. I mean, these are things that doesn't take too much to understand. But humor, for better or worse, is a little bit harder. So here we are 40 years later trying to do a Raven, these outrageous things that Raven does, and tell him it's okay to laugh.
Nora, are you finding another reading for us?
Do you want me to read another one?
If you would. I think it would be wonderful.
Here's one I did on names, Thinkit names, in memory of Jeff David. Jeff David was a fantastic basketball player. And I'm a basketball fan. I don't go to much lately, but I wrote this. Basketball, his name was Chokis, which means his ribs are like bracelet. In memory of Jeff David, regional basketball, All-American Hall of Famer. Even your name proclaims it in Thinkit, Chokis. Wolf rib like a bracelet, like a hoop. Scoring hook shots at center. Shooting from the key, your body motion forming a hoop, wolfing up points.
What a wonderful piece that is. Wow.
Trying to find
We have just a minute left.
Oh, okay. So, well, we leadership talk rather than...
I have just one question that I wanted to ask Nora, and that is, what do you hope to accomplish as poet laureate or writer laureate?
Well, I think I'll just continue working with whoever is asking me questions about Tlingit. That's what I'm doing now.
Well, you've truly found a wonderful life's work, and you're an inspiration to all of us. Congratulations. A better choice could not have been made.
Thank you.
Wasayati, wekushitlaukha, agwa ge ach sik awe, hu awe, hu awe, adu sik awe.
The music in the background is a Tlingit lullaby for girls, we thought appropriate for the interview. Tune in tomorrow, on Monday, when Katie Bousler is hosting the show. Kim Kiefer will be here with an update on city activities. Nicole Hallingstad will come in to talk about the Saturday Women's Health Forum. Houston Laws will be here about a new dog running business called Run 'em Crazy to Lazy. And Christy Anami McErickson will be here with news about Friday's Grand Poetry Slam. And there are the usual features of Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more, as Katie Bousler hosts Juno Afternoon on KTO News on Monday. You're in tune with KTOO News. We are in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210 AS at 89.9. Pat Moore hosting today. Good afternoon to you all.